You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson on today's programme.
I don't have a message to the Muslim community. I have a message to people, to all people, that we have to do things differently. Talk to each other, meet each other, know each other in our differences. We shouldn't be all the same.
As Denmark buries the victims of last week's attacks in Copenhagen, we'll examine how Europe's countries are reacting differently in their security provisions. The journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI will join me to discuss that and some more of the day's top news stories. Also ahead, we welcome the resurrection of an international arts prize in Oslo. The Munch Prize is back after a 10-year hiatus. And before the end of the programme, we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world and...
In heaven, do you get horns under the hammer?
Are you a carrot?
Do you get Dickinson's
Look,
Rattle Dick?
It's not 20 bloody questions, you pair of idiots.
Oh, an idiot, you say?
We review the latest hits and misses in the world of comedy. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. But before all that, let's get the latest world news. Here's Paul Osborne.
Ukrainian government forces are withdrawing from the town of Debaltseve after fierce fighting with pro-Russian rebels despite a ceasefire. Russia blames Ukraine for the violence, accusing government troops of trying to fight their way out of the city. But Ukraine's president Petro Poroshenko says they were never surrounded. NATO's Secretary General has said the rebel assault on Debaltseve had put the wider peace deal at risk. The EU's foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini says Russia must act to restrain the rebels.
The developments in Debaltseve in Ukraine were clearly a violation of the ceasefire, of the agreements that were signed. Not only the European Union, but the whole international community stands for a full implementation of all points of the Minsk agreement reached last week.
Swiss investigators have been searching the offices of a subsidiary of HSBC as part of the inquiry into alleged money laundering. Officials say it was prompted by the leak of documents suggesting HSBC's private banking operation in Switzerland had helped wealthy customers to avoid paying tax. The bank says it's cooperating with Swiss authorities. The UN envoy to Syria says the country's government has offered to halt its aerial bombardment of Aleppo for 6 weeks. Stefan de Mistura says it would be a trial ceasefire, but it's not clear when it would take effect. Government forces have been trying to cut off a critical rebel supply route in Aleppo. Greece will formally request a six-month extension of its loan from other countries in the Eurozone, but officials in Athens say it won't be a renewal of the current bailout, which brings with it strict austerity measures opposed by the country's new government. If a deal can't be agreed, Greece risks running out of money by the end of February. But financial analyst Carsten Breschke doesn't think it'll come to that.
I don't expect the ECB to take this decision in the middle of ongoing negotiations in Brussels. What I would think is that the ECB will come up with a bit of an extension of the emergency liquidity assistance to again buy time.
Nigeria's military says that more than 300 Boko Haram fighters have been killed in an operation to retake the garrison town of Mungunu in the northeast of the country. Officials say some militants were captured. Two soldiers died. Boko Haram seized control of Mungunu last month, sparking fears of an imminent assault on the regional capital, Maiduguri. Indonesia has reacted angrily to Australia's latest call for it to spare the lives of two drug offenders on death row. They're among nine people convicted in 2005 as the ringleaders of a plot to smuggle heroin out of Indonesia. Executions resumed there in 2013 after a five-year gap. But officials in Jakarta have said they're upset that Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott referred to the assistance his country had offered to Indonesia after the Indian Ocean tsunami.
We are doing no more for our citizens than Indonesia routinely does for its own citizens, and if it's right and proper for Indonesia to make these representations, if it's right and proper for other countries to heed Indonesia's representations, it's right and proper for us to make the representations and for them to be heeded.
It's claimed 4,000 migrants have been rescued in the last 5 days trying to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa. The International Organization for Migration says even more people are likely to attempt the dangerous journey as fighting continues in Libya. It's claimed there's been a 60% increase in the number of people trying to smuggle themselves into Europe via the Mediterranean compared to a year ago. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vas à Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is
Londres. Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Time here in London is 18:06. In New York, it's 13:06. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio is the journalist and commentator Geoffrey Kaufman and Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London. Welcome, gentlemen, both to the programme.
Thank you.
Let us begin with a look at how 3 days on Denmark and indeed the rest of Europe are handling the aftermath of the Copenhagen attacks. France, we know, deployed extra troops and officers on the streets after the Charlie Hebdo shootings. And in Italy today, almost 5,000 extra troops are to be sent to some of the most country's most sensitive sites. Let me begin with you, Geoffrey. What's your reaction to the way that the Danish have been very understated in their security approach to the aftermath of these shootings?
Well, I think the Danish and the Swedish bodyguards really deserve a lot of credit, first of all. This could have been an even more horrific massacre. They tried to get into that cafe over the weekend, and the gunman, he met counterfire before he could get in. Sadly, one person died, but it could have been much worse. So, you know, some of these measures do obviously pay off, but... You know, I was in the U.S. during and after 9/11, and one of the things that you become almost jaded about the kind of the false sense of security you get from these guards on the streets. And this, we live in open societies, and unless we're going to lock people in their homes, it really is impossible to protect the world. But, you know, they have to do something. And I think the threat is real. I mean, I'm not a scaremonger. As a journalist, I'm a skeptic about scaremongering. But, you know, we've seen these patterns. And what we're seeing are these lone wolves, and they're much harder to track down than conspiracies that can be tracked over the internet to someone pulling the command from Syria or elsewhere.
There has been this very strange difference, really, in the way that the world has expected, let's say, when France experienced the Charlie Hebdo shootings. There was an immediate reaction from the French government and there was an immediate presence on the streets. And by in contrast, no one has really called for that to happen in Denmark. In fact, just speaking to someone from the Danish military earlier on today, I said, have you done anything? And they went, no, one maniac, that's it. You can't do anything about one maniac. And that's all it is.
Well, I think there was a difference, a qualitative and quantitative difference in the sort of attack that we did see in Paris and the one we saw in Copenhagen. The one that we saw in Paris was clearly a sort of coordinated, the two brothers went in, shot the journalist they were targeting, and then clearly had a plan for what they were going to do next. This other chap, Amedi Coulibaly, a friend of theirs, did a similar attack at the same time. He shot a cop and then he went into that supermarket. I mean, it was a much more substantial thing. This was one guy going and shooting up this screening, I think it was, of a film or something. He sort of shot up that cultural event and then went off to take a pot shot at someone in the synagogue and then sort of headed home. It is a different kind of sort of attack.
Would you not say, though, that there are lots and lots of similarities between these two attacks? Okay, the number of those involved in Paris was higher, but let's look at the backgrounds of the gunmen. They all born in either France or Denmark. They're all disaffected young men, parts of gangs, went into prison where they're radicalized.
It's the same story in the Canadian Parliament. Yeah. You know, this was a disaffected guy who wasn't particularly a fundamentalist, but you know, this is the one of the consequences and one of the concerns of our global village, our wired world, that people get these ideas. ideas by being loners in their little bedrooms, going through the internet and getting ideas of grandeur, even if it's this perverse grandeur.
Well, I mean, I think that there is. I think that we don't know the whole picture on what happened in these plots, but what I think we do know when we look at the Paris one is that these were guys who had connected with Al Qaeda in Yemen, which is one of Al Qaeda's more active entities trying to launch attacks outside the country. It's possible that there's actually more to that one than it being a bunch of guys who decided to do these things of their own volition. It could be there was some sort of direction, some sort of command and control. That's a qualitatively different thing to a kid who's come 2 weeks out of prison for where he was doing GBH or something like that, and then him sort of, you know, deciding to go and launch this attack. So I think there's that sort of element. The other thing, and I think the reason you're seeing this ramped up security presence across Europe suddenly, is very much the copycat thing. What we've noticed is when you see an attack happen, others sort of will see this and see, oh, now is the moment to do an attack because you'll have more impact. And so that people resonates, you know, and so this one kid in Denmark may in fact have been a bit of a copycat off the Charlie Hebdo guys. Certainly after he had the Woolwich incident here in 2013, like the next week there was a guy who stabbed a soldier in La Défense in Paris. So, you know, it happens periodically, and so this is why they ramp up security. And the more of these things you see happen, the more other people will get excited and say, ah, yes, now is really the moment to strike.
And I would point out that you know, I think there's a broader geopolitical concern here, and that is the absolute disintegration of Libya. You know, Libya is not Iraq, it is not Afghanistan. It is, and Sirte is 300 kilometers from Italian shores, and you know, this horrific, just absolutely gut-wrenching beheadings of these Egyptian Coptic Christians over the weekend, 21 of them. By these insane people who say they're acting in the name of Allah on the coast of Libya, really is a threat. We have seen ISIS in Syria. We have seen ISIS in Iraq and on the borders of Turkey. But to see ISIS so close to Europe, I think it's Libya's ambassador to the UK has said this is, you know, you better be prepared. They're going to come over in boats. And, you know, it's not hard to imagine. It's not that hard. We keep hearing about all these boats that are being rescued by the Italian Navy and the EU forces in the Mediterranean. We are really vulnerable, and Libya is the doorstep of Europe.
And up to 5,000 extra troops are being sent to some of the most countries, to Italy's most sensitive sites, to patrol them and to protect them. Raffaella, just listening to what Geoffrey was saying in terms of the way that geographically the Islamic State conflict is getting closer and closer to mainland Europe. You wrote an article in the Italian publication Panorama a few days ago where you were effectively saying that for a long time, people have been mistakenly fearing that the threat comes from abroad. It actually comes from within a country, and then people go abroad to get inspiration to bring the fight back home. Does the Libyan beheadings not change that?
No, well, I think in some ways what Geoffrey was talking about in terms of Libya disintegrating as a state is, I think, the bigger problem. I think that the issue there is that you have got a country right across the borders that is right across the European sort of, the Mediterranean. It's, you know, it's fallen apart and there's absolutely no control. And you've got all sorts of groups that are controlling different parts of it. And it's possible that they might try to launch attacks outside. We haven't really seen that happen yet, is the thing I would say, as Libya has been problematic for a very long time. Places like Derna, Benghazi and Sirte, they've been exporting radicals for a very long time. If you go back and look at the American-led invasion of Iraq, and you look at the sort of foreign fighters that were going in there, there was a lot of Libyans from these same kinds of cities who were going there. So we're dealing with clearly parts of the country which have very strong sort of traditions of this kind of fighting. If that starts to export itself, it could. But I would argue it's actually more likely to be a problem regionally. The thing then for Italy, of course, is that Italy has got huge investments in Libya. You know, Eni is one of the biggest players out there. Italy's got a long tradition of sort of substantial economic interests across the border there. So for them, it does play into this sort of bigger picture. I think putting soldiers on the streets, making this sorts of statements, probably plays to a sort of political card that the Italians are trying to highlight about the fact that they feel like they're on their own here, and they feel like they're footing the bill for a problem that ultimately is all of Europe's, and no one's really kind of paying attention. I think Frontex, which is the European sort of borders agency, did say they were going to put a bit of money towards it and deploy some forces, but it was a nominal sum, you know. And when you're looking at the Italians are picking out, what was it, 2,000-5,000 people per day or per week? I don't know. I mean, this is huge, and it's hugely costly for them, and no one seems to be sort of getting it. So I think there's a sort of a need in the Italian body politic to get more attention around this kind of issue.
So does And when you have those volumes, how do you know whether some of the people in those boats are have other ideas? And, you know, it I really do think we have to worry about it, and I don't think there are easy solutions, and I have a horrible feeling we're going to see more awful things happen.
Is there not perhaps a feeling that it is now time for a more Europe-wide policy to be adopted, given the fact that each country has taken such a different approach? Denmark has prided itself in connecting, communicating, intelligence being coming from talking to extremist Muslims. The French and now the Italians are responding with guns.
I mean, I think you've got a traditional problem here of harmonization across the continent, you know, and this has always been an issue. And when Schengen sort of decided to open everything up and gave this free movement, I mean, it was fantastic for all of us who can sort of travel around with much greater ease, but it means other people can travel around with greater ease as well. And it has caused a huge problem. And you've got different legal jurisdictions across the continent, and they all have different things. And the police forces are very different as well. You know, if you were to go and talk to Polish or Eastern European cops about counterterrorism, they probably really haven't handled much of it because it's just not been a priority issue for them. Whereas if you're sitting in London or you're sitting in Paris, this is sort of the big issue. So you've got that hugely sort of disparate reaction. And there is a lot of effort that's going in at a European level to try to get greater harmonization. But you're talking about criminal justice. You're talking about national security. And that really cuts to, you know, people's sense of nationhood.
Let's move on to the subject which many argue was in fact the root cause of the rise of Islamic State. The Syrian regime has said it is happy to suspend the bombardment of the city of Aleppo to see if a six-week ceasefire can hold. Opposition forces in the country's civil war have expressed their doubts, not least because there's evidence already of ground troops trying to cut off a key supply route into the city. Jeffrey, what are your thoughts on this ceasefire being announced?
Is there actually a war going on in Syria? I hadn't noticed. I haven't seen it talked about very much in the news pages. I think what's just horrific is that this has gone on now for almost 4 years, and it is just taken for granted that it's going to that there's something going on there. I mean, it's fallen below the radar. The death toll, 200,000. Aleppo, a city of 2 million people, virtually deserted now. So many millions displaced. Humanitarian crises on every border. It's appalling. So, you know, I guess on one level we can hope that this micro truce, because it's just a small regional truce, will actually work. I mean, so little has, and so much suffering continues. I think we've talked about this before. There almost seems to be a strategy. I don't think I have to qualify it, that we'll just let Syria bump along because we can't get rid of Assad, and the opposition's not much, and it doesn't have clean hands either. And there's been this, as long as it's contained, then there's not much intervention required or that we can do. This is a glimmer of light in the darkness.
Would you disagree that this is one little bit of hope?
I mean, you have to look for optimism where you can find it, right? And in such dark situations, any sort of light is positive. But, I mean, Jeffrey's right. It's a total mess, and I don't see any resolution coming soon. And, you know, the fact that Stefan de Mistura has persuaded Assad to suspend bombing in one city in the country, I don't know if he's talked to the rebels about this at all, or got them really on board, or all of the rebel groups. I mean, it goes back to when they had the meetings in Geneva, whenever it was. You know, you sort of looked at the people who were there, and you thought, well, I didn't see ISIS sitting around the table. I didn't see Jabhat al-Nusra around the table. I didn't see Ahrar al-Sham around the table. And these are the groups who are holding territory on the ground. So we're not even able to get to that stage of discussing with everybody, all the participants actually playing a role. You know, this is positive, and I'm sure will make the people of Aleppo their lives a little bit easier for a few days, or months, or I don't know. But it doesn't feel like this is the beginning of the end.
The announcement came with a sort of a measure of cynicism as well. And Staffan de Mistura, the Secretary General of Ban Ki-moon's special representative for Syria, brought this ceasefire to the public eye. He also said that just watch, the Syrian authorities, the Syrian troops will try and move in quickly before the ceasefire takes place. And look what happened today.
Well, and you know, we saw the same in Ukraine as well. I think one of the interesting things that is worth noting about this conflict is Europe's attitude towards Assad. Assad has understandably, at least from a Western perspective, been seen as a pariah. And you know, the hope was that the Arab Spring would bring him down. That hasn't happened. In the process, most European countries pulled their ambassadors, closed their embassies. And now you're seeing a rumbling amongst some countries that maybe not having dialogue isn't working, and maybe we should start think about reopening embassies, reconnecting, because like it or not, as bad as he is, he's there, and we haven't, and this stalemate isn't helping. The problem is that you have two very big players, France and Britain, saying no. We're not talking to him. But you are starting to see some division. And I think it's just a recognition of the reality. As bad as he is, he's there. And as you know, as history teaches us over and over again, not talking to people just accomplishes nothing.
So, Raf, would you agree that this little ceasefire is perhaps an attempt by Assad to woo the international community?
Certainly. I mean, he did that interview with the BBC the other day in which he sort of painted himself, managed to project himself as a slightly more accommodationist and trying to bring this situation to resolution. And I'm sure he's heard these rumblings that one hears around European capitals of, you know, maybe we do need to start to think about talking to Assad. And, you know, he realizes if he holds on and if he can start demonstrating that he's able to be a bit of a conciliator, maybe then he'll start to get the international support. That means that, you know, he can start to see some sort of conclusion to this. I'm sure he doesn't want this conflict to go on forever and ever. Either. But I, you know, it doesn't, I'm sure it is a cynical ploy by him, but I think that it's unlikely to really qualitatively change much.
To what degree do you think that Hezbollah might have some influence in this? It's now announced that it is moving into Iraq to fight, but it's also been instrumental in the battle in helping the Assad regime get Aleppo.
I think that's probably more to do, I mean, them moving into Iraq is more to do with their relationship with Iran and the Iranians sort of redeploying forces around there. We've seen the Iranians play a huge role in sort of trying to count and trying to fight, support the Assad regime on the one side and the Iraqi government on the other. Whether this particular sort of change, this truce has some sort of connection to that, I don't know. I would be surprised if there was a direct link there. I mean, Hezbollah has been very active across the country.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here. This is Emma Nelson, joined by the journalist and commentator Geoffrey Kaufman and Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London. When we return, we'll assess the boundaries between commercial and journalistic interests as a prominent British newspaper columnist resigns. Stay with us.
Our first Monocle Quality of Life Conference is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal, from Friday the 17th to Sunday the 19th of April. Over 3 days, and with the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe. Guest speakers include the legendary typographer Eric Spiekerman, celebrated architect Bjarke Ingels, and the V&A's director Martin Roth. This is an intimate weekend, and we know that important conversations will continue long after the speakers have left the stage. So we'll make sure there's plenty of opportunities to talk at the receptions, at the final night's dinner, and beyond. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference in Lisbon, Portugal, from the 17th to the 19th of April. Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
It's 2022 in Athens, 1822 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, the journalist and commentator Geoffrey Kaufman and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI. Now, let us examine the actions of the chief political commentator at the Daily Telegraph, or rather the former man in that position, a traditional daily, British broadsheet, may we describe the Daily Telegraph. He's resigned in protest at what he believes is an editorial policy not to criticise the private companies that place adverts in his paper. Peter O'Born had already decided to go, but he says he was so outraged at what he saw as his boss's relegation of the HSB scandal to a few pars at the bottom of page two. Geoffrey Kaufman, he's called this a fraud on its readers. What are your initial thoughts on this?
As a journalist, it's deeply depressing. You know, he if you read his article on opendemocracy.net, his resignation letter, or his why I've resigned letter, he makes a pretty persuasive argument. And while the Telegraph's official line is dismissive and accuses him of fabrication, that doesn't really cut it as a counter. What he's essentially saying is, and it's not just HSBC, but HSBC is obviously for him that it is the biggest of his complaints. HSBC, the Telegraph did a series of stories a couple of years ago in 2012. HSBC suspended its advertising. This has happened to a number of news organizations. When the Panorama ran this very damning story about people seconding their money in HSBC Switzerland and HSBC soliciting this, and it ran on the front pages of The Guardian, The Times, the FT here in London, not a peep from the Telegraph. And O'Born is right. I mean, it's just outrageous. The Barclay brothers are shills for HSBC. I mean, that's what's happened to this. You know, living in London, I moved here 5 years ago, and as a journalist, you have this vast media landscape. And one of the things I did was study what media do I want and where do I, you can't read every paper every day. And, you know, for me, I think that the best three papers in London are The Guardian, The Telegraph, and The FT. That's just my opinion as a journalist. And they represent a completely divergent perspective, The Guardian being liberal, The Telegraph being conservative. Well, I think you can say there are two papers now. I mean, Obourne points out, and I think it kind of speaks of where the Barclay brothers are, that in 80 or 90 years, the Telegraph had six editors. Since the Barclays took over about 10, 12 years ago, they've had six more. Yeah. I mean, these guys are not running an institution in its traditional way. They are, and they're panicking, of course, like every newspaper, but, you know, is the way to panic to pander, and that's what he's saying.
Raffaello, is this more upsetting because it is the newspaper that Geoffrey clearly has so dearly loved in the past?
Well, liked. I wouldn't say loved. That, just for the record, but it's well written. It has been well written.
And Obourne has indeed said that its accuracy in its news reporting has always been good, and its readers, he says, are decent people with a stake in the country. Mm. Not to get too domestic, but would this have been a bit less of a surprise had it come from a paper which doesn't necessarily have such a strong spine, one would say?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends where you kind of situate the Telegraph on the sort of spectrum of British newspapers. Myself, I always thought of it as a very conservative newspaper. And in some ways, the fact that it turns out that they are, that their leadership is keen to sort of pander to business, kind of doesn't surprise me in a way. I mean, I kind of can see it
this
fitting into
that. Pandering to business. Sorry, I take an issue with that. I mean, the FT panders to business. The Times of London panders to business. This is pandering to advertiser. This is the great
But I mean,
wall.
The advertising comes from the business.
We've always believed as journalists
company,
that there's a wall.
HSBC that, you know, is particularly agitated about this.
And that throws its weight around. I mean, hey, I've got to come clean. My accounts are at HSBC. I'm not support. I don't keep that bank afloat. They abuse their position. It's a long tradition. You offend a department store, the department store will pull its ads from the paper. But HSBC thinking it can, its own malfeasance. I mean, we're not talking about little stories. These are we're talking about money laundering. We're talking about breaking the law in many cases. And the stories over the years about HSBC and the idea that you write about our criminal activity and we will punish you. Excuse me?
No, I mean, it's scandalous, but I don't... if I'm going to talk about the Telegraph and where I kind of see it on the spectrum, it didn't totally surprise me. Let's put it that way. Do I think that it's a scandalous story? Yes, absolutely. And I do think that, the fact that HSBC have been doing the activities are being revealed are extraordinary to me. I mean, the sort of levels of criminality, frankly, that's underway is sort of extraordinary. And it seems like the bank is continuing getting punished. They've invested now a huge amount in trying to... they've recruited a lot of people to do sort of more due diligence and do more checks on things, but it just doesn't seem to be working.
Doesn't it make you want to take a spray can with you when you get off an airplane and see HSBC, the World
yes,
Bank, and just
everywhere.
Put graffiti and say the world's thieves or something like that? It really is outrageous. And Obourne makes a good point in his note. He says, what's really obscene about this is how much glee they express when the BBC does this kind of thing, and when the BBC transgresses. And here they are, and they're saying, "Oh no, you're just way off, Obourne." I've met Obourne. He is a conservative commentator. This guy is not a liberal apologist for anything. And for him to go after, his own ideological soulmates and say this, it's searing.
It's hard to say this, though, but Obourne had already resigned and was on his way out. The Telegraph, as you have mentioned, has been slashing its budgets, and there was a wave of redundancies a few months ago. Many of the staff there are expecting a second wave in the next couple of months. To what degree will Obourne have actually made his star blaze a little bit brighter today in an effort to survive a little bit longer?
Good on him. Good on him.
Well, if you're going to go out, go out with a bang. Why
well,
not?
Well, and people need to be aware of what's happening in journalism. Yeah. And to be clear, in the Telegraph, and I don't want to say in defense, but they've got lots of company. I mean, you look at American television, you look at a lot of regional newspapers, this kind of boosterism and this fear of losing advertisers, it's an epidemic as newspapers go through this crisis of realignment caused by mostly the internet, but the economic crisis of a few years ago, too.
Geoffrey's right, isn't he, Raffaello? He the Telegraph is not alone in doing this, and an awful lot blends and blurs and editorial values, which if you work in broadcasting, to which you have to adhere, otherwise, you know, woe betide you, that never really gets examined, does it?
No, I don't think it does, sadly enough. And in some ways, I suppose the thing that will hopefully come out of this story is that people will look at this with a greater sort of attentiveness, because it is a question as newspapers, because, you know, newspapers is a tradition where you go to get those sort of long, in-depth stories that really dig into some sort of investigation or uncover some sort of malfeasance, corruption, I don't know. You know, and if newspapers are increasingly in cutback and increasingly in their budget slashed, they're going to be looking for more funding. And so it's possible that we're going to see more of this sort of thing happening. And so the more it can be exposed, the more it can be highlighted, the better it is, because the better it will mean that the newspapers that are able to continue are, you know, credible voices. And that's very important.
You know, I teach journalism, and one of the things that I teach is the rise of the global brand. And you know, you're seeing as good journalism diminishes, you're seeing people turn to the same brand. You're seeing, for example, The Guardian, which has this very strange economic model, the Scott Trust that owns it. It's not owned. It has, there's one share owned by the trust. You know, it has £1 billion in investments and assets. It technically loses money, but it has so much money from the trust and its very smart investments over the decades that it is financially independent. And now it has offices in Australia, in the U.S., and it has huge circulation online as a result. And this, in the New York Times, similarly, I should say the Daily Mail as well. But you know, you're seeing, and I think we're going to see this phenomenon more micro media and more macro, big scale, global media.
Very briefly, you have about 30 seconds. It is a sort of very bitter pill to swallow, but would we ultimately have to see a world of open compromise whereby, to ensure the survival of newspapers, which is obviously such a, you know, perilous place at the moment, are we going to have to see a little bit more open collaboration in terms of big businesses and sponsorship? If they came clean a bit more, would we sort of have to swallow it a bit?
I don't want to be the editor who makes those choices.
You know what I mean? I think it would depend what they're writing about. If you're talking about writing about banking stories, nature sees paying for it, well, I don't know about that. You know,
a friend of mine who worked in fashion once said, I said, what do you do when you think it's terrible? And he said, we do nothing. You know, we edit by omission.
Jeffrey Coffin and Raffaella Fantucci, thank you very much indeed for joining me on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. See on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our correspondents around the world. I think Liam Aldous is waiting for us in Spain. And we'll get the latest hits and misses from the comedy circuits before the end of the programme. But before all that, with the time at just 33 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest world news headlines now. Here's Paul.
Ukrainian government forces have withdrawn from the town of Debaltseve after fierce fighting with pro-Russian rebels, despite the ceasefire. Russia has blamed Ukraine for the violence, saying government troops tried to fight their way out of the city. Ukraine's president says they were never surrounded. Swiss investigators have been searching the offices of a subsidiary of HSBC as part of inquiries into alleged money laundering. Officials say it was prompted by the leak of documents suggesting that HSBC's private banking operation in Switzerland had been helping wealthy customers to avoid paying tax. Nigeria's military says more than 300 Boko Haram fighters have been killed in an operation to retake the garrison town of Mungunu in the northeast of the country. Officials say that some militants were captured, two soldiers died. Last month, Boko Haram seized control of Mungunu, sparking fears of an imminent assault on Maiduguri, the regional capital. And Greece is to formally request a six-month extension of its loan from other countries in the eurozone. But officials in Athens have said it won't be a renewal of the current bailout, which would bring with it strict austerity measures, which are opposed by the country's new government. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Paul will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news. And then after that, Daniel Giacopelli will be here on Monocle 24 with the entrepreneurs. Monocle 24's Business Hour. In the meantime, though, welcome back to Midori House. We're live here on Monocle 24. The time is at 21:34 if you're listening in Moscow, 18:34 here in London. This is Emma Nelson checking in with one of our correspondents today. Let's head to Spain. I'm joined now on the line from Madrid by Liam Aldous, Monocle's correspondent in the city. Welcome as ever to the programme, Liam. Let us talk about tax amnesties and, well, the mysteries that lurk beneath.
Yeah, a very fun topic for everyone involved. Basically, this controversy has been stirred because the head of Spain's tax department has come out announcing an inquiry into a few individuals who filed for this tax amnesty that was a big part of the Conservative government's reform package when they came into power in 2011. Basically, the tax amnesty itself was expected to raise about 2.5 billion euros in back taxes, but actually only raised about half that amount. And because it also covered cash earned, basically a lot of people are now questioning whether people use the tax amnesty to legitimize money laundering operations. So this is all part of, as well, the HSBC scandal, the names that were handed to the Spanish government, 600 names, Spanish names, people who had stashed money away in Swiss bank accounts were named. And basically now we're seeing continuous fallout. And basically a lot of people are questioning the timing because this comes after quite a few years of the tax amnesty, and now it's an election year, so the government's trying to look tough on cracking down on corporate cheats.
Yes, at the same time, it looks as if it was not really paying that much attention to what was happening because it lowered the penalty rates in the amnesty and perhaps, by all accounts, turned a blind eye to all this.
Yeah, that's definitely as well the perception in amongst the public. But it's not just the ruling Conservatives. The Socialist Party, which was in power before, also when they were handed the list of names, didn't clamp down on these tax cheats, but actually sent them a letter advising them and giving them the option to basically clear their name and settle their tax before they actually prosecuted them. So both the major political parties are tarnished here, and this is just feeding into these smaller parties like Podemos, which are trying to taint both parties with the same brush, successfully, might I add.
I was about to say, to what degree is Podemos actually making political capital out of this? Because they are absolutely on the up and up.
Well, one of their lines is the two major parties, particularly the Conservatives, are just trying to help their big corporate friends, and this just furnishes that perception even more. So this is a recent development. So I'm sure the people, the strategizers with Podemos are working on the new political lines. They're quite handy with the catchphrases recently, so we'll see what they come up with in the next few days.
Let's move on to another great institution of Spain, which is coming under a battering, TVE. Right, huge problems there for some time now, but not, they don't seem to be getting any better, is that right?
Well, no, they're just getting worse, actually. And this is actually a very sad story. The public broadcaster has just lost a lot of credibility, particularly take you back to 2004, a lot of people criticised the public broadcaster as just a government mouthpiece. There was particular government interference in the editorial room and news content, and people turned to other channels for news. But then the socialists came in and basically tried to change the format and model the TV, make the TVE model based on kind of like the BBC. So there was a bit of editorial independence. And then when the Conservatives won in 2011, they had a parliamentary majority. So they overturned that complete reform. And Ana Pastor, who was a very tough journalist on the morning program and used to give some of the toughest interviews, was actually fired. And this has basically was the opening shot in what has been a very sad battle and a loss of credibility for the public broadcaster. The most recent development is the creation of a separate parallel newsroom to cover the elections. And the new director of TVE, he's only been in the job for under a year, has basically hand-picked journalists from some very conservative media outlets, very, very right-wing independent media outlets to basically cover the elections. And a lot of the journalists in TV have, and the union representing them, has come out criticising this move, particularly because some seasoned journalists have been moved to departments covering agriculture and the sign language division, which is a very sad development.
It does sound one of those tragic things when the when trust in the impartiality and independence of a newsroom suddenly becomes questioned so much that the newsroom itself has to change. To what degree do you think that TVE's susceptibility to pressure will mean that it'll be a very, very long time before anybody else trusts this broadcaster again?
I think a similar reform will have to be brought in following next year's elections to bring back editorial independence at least. Budget cuts as well have really damaged the station's standing. It's lost a lot of its programming power as well. A lot of the good shows have had to be cancelled. So, but what we're seeing across the board is some of the other channels have news channels and debate shows have really sprung up. And as you well know, I did a feature in the forecast on these new political TV shows, which are actually succeeding in the wake of the sorry state of the public broadcaster.
And finally, Liam, and reasonably briefly, if you don't mind too much, Spanish stereotypes, we can name them endlessly, but by all accounts, we like a classier kind of stereotype nowadays than we did in years gone by.
What do you think, Emma, when you think of Spain? Let me just ask you that quickly.
I wouldn't possibly ever begin to... I don't know where I would begin, Liam. I think of you, because you're the most regular contact I have with Spain.
Well, I'm the only non-Spanish element. Well, basically, a new study has just come out showing that while football and bulls are still big Spanish symbols, the siesta and flamenco have fallen in perceptions as symbols in perceptions of Spain. But what's actually increased is the crisis. The economic situation is now one of the primary images or symbols that foreigners have when they think of Spain, according to this study. So it's not looking good for the Spanish, who are very worried these days about how foreigners see them, particularly because of all the negative news going on in their country. So a lot of work needs to be done to get that word crisis out of the three top elements when people think of Spain.
The general image of Spain is improving, though. People are slightly happier with Spain.
It's true. It has climbed 1 point. It was in 2012, when the same study was carried out, it was around 6.5 out of 10, and now it's a steady 6.9. So it is getting better, but I think they might need to focus some more marketing energy on flamenco and maybe less of the siesta, and hopefully that will overshadow the crisis.
Liam Aldous, Monocle's Madrid correspondent and soft power representative of the city. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, another example of soft power. We'll be asking why the Munch Prize, one of Norway's most noted arts awards, is to come back after a 10-year gap. Stay with us.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, after almost 10 years away, Norway is to reinstate the Edvard Munch Award. It is a prize given to an outstanding example of collaboration between Norwegian and international artists. When it slipped away a decade ago, there was an outcry, although it had only been apparently handed out twice. Well, joining us now from Oslo is Katja Garcia Anton, who's director of the Office for Contemporary Art Norway, OCA, the organisation which is bringing back the Munch Award. A very warm welcome to the program, Katja. Before we ask why it's come back, can you explain to us why it went away in the first place?
Yes, good evening. I think one of the reasons, I mean, I wasn't here at the time, but one of the reasons that it went away was very much to do with the lack of funding. And now there's a new sponsor in place, and actually the prize has moved on from our organization, and it's been taken up by the Munch Museum. And this reflects in many ways the new leadership of the Munch Museum. They're looking far more than they did before to have an international sort of relevance. And it also reflects the fact that our organization is focusing far more on one of its other most important tools, which is the Venice Biennial and the Nordic Pavilion in the Venice Biennial. Both the Munch Award and the Venice Biennial are important ways to get Norway to be more connected internationally and more visible internationally.
Explain to us a little bit more. I mean, I said at the beginning of this that it was a prize for a good collaboration between Norwegian and international artists. Who were the great figures at the time? Where was Norway looking 10 years ago? And how has that changed?
Well, yes, no, the two editions, one was in 2005, the other in 2006, the awardees at the time, one was German, Alice Kreischner. She is an artist, curator and writer. So very much looking at the crossovers between theory and practice, I suppose, in her figure. And the other person was Amar Kawar, an Indian artist and filmmaker, and somebody bringing into the international discourse a very new and fresh way of looking at issues of the region, of the South Asian region, but also that impacted environmental issues internationally. So that's, you know, those were the two sort of pivotal international routes for those two editions.
The award, therefore, went to two people who weren't Norwegian. I mean, to what degree was that a factor in its disappearance?
No, I don't think that was a factor at all. The award was always conceived as a way of honoring international practice, as a way of showing the world that the Norwegian community thought very highly of international practice and wanted a greater connectivity with it. And I think those two elements are very much part of the awards as it's going to be launched today. You know, Norway is a country which is continuing to strive and continuing to grow with regards to its relationship with the world, with the artistic community in the world. And it's now in the last decade, actually, interestingly enough, the last decade has really seen Norway and Oslo in particular boom in a very, very dynamic way. Its infrastructure is stronger than ever. The artistic community is incredibly dynamic. There's a whole new set of projects launching new museums across the city, for example. So it's really sort of set on the brink of having a very great impact internationally.
Which is very exciting. And the jury that will be selected on this panel for the prize will have an international feel to it. Who do you think will be appointed? What kind of people are you looking for as judges?
Well, this will be a decision for the director of the Munch Museum, but I can imagine that it's going to be a mixture between quite heavyweight people, you know, directors of major international museums. And also, I would imagine it would be a good thing if it had a sort of international spread, that it wasn't all connected to Europe or to a Euro-American axis of influence, but it did look towards emerging areas of the world, since from a contemporary art perspective, those other emerging areas of the world are actually some of the ones producing the most interesting work these days.
The people behind the organisation of the Munch Museum have said that, you know, for now this is a brilliant, brilliant example of the name Edvard Munch being used on an in an international way at last. How much do you think that that will be a great example of Norwegian soft power?
Yes, I think so. I think it's important for Norway to find ways in which its past continues to be relevant today. And when you talk about soft power, I imagine you're thinking a little bit about the way in which Norwegian politics is branded internationally. And it's true that Norway does have a leverage internationally with regards to, you know, various humanitarian crises and the role that the government here has played in those crises. So to some extent, making a position, carving out a position whereby it also has an influence internationally through such a major prize as this makes a lot of sense, and it will be good for the international community as much as it will be good for the Norwegian community.
We look very much forward to it being awarded. Katja Garcia Aton, Director of the Office for Contemporary Art Norway, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today, we talk comedy and looking for belly laughs while Bruce Dessau, arts critic for London's Evening Standard newspaper, joins me in the studio now. Making yourself comfortable, Bruce, we shall begin. What is tickling your ribs at the minute?
Well, all sorts. There's live comedy, there's TV. I think, can I mention this, talk about sitcom, BBC Two sitcom first
you
of
can.
All?
You can. I mean, we have a generally international audience, yes. So if you can cast your net as wide as you can.
You can find this probably somewhere on the internet, anywhere in the world. It's Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, who returned this week with House of Fools. It's the second series of their sitcom. And I think we're going through a bit of a golden age of sitcoms at the moment. Last time I was on, I talked about Catastrophe, which is a Channel 4 sitcom that's doing very well. And I thought that might be my favourite sitcom of the whole year. But I think Vic and Bob's House of Fools could actually be even better than it. It's just a pure slapstick. Well, actually, it's not pure slapstick. It's slapstick comedy, knockabout, stupid comedy, but with a sort of classic, with that kind of their trademark surreal element to it. So it's... You know, it's not just falling over and hitting people. It's people being sort of being hit quite badly, I would say, but in a silly way. It's like clowning on television.
You're not really selling it to me, but I kind of get what you mean.
It made me laugh out loud, and I don't like to spoil it because it's one of these things. The things, you know, there's a scene where a cupboard opens and a cup falls out, but instead of one cup falling out, about 2,000 cups fall out. It just goes beyond. It goes beyond what you'd expect if your shelf collapsed and a cup would fall over. Cups just cascade out of the cupboard, and it is hilarious.
It's simple as well. Yes. And to what degree is this a return to? You said a golden age, but yeah. People going back to what works, which is the daft stuff in life.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think we've had this in recent years with Miranda, obviously, and the falling over in Miranda. And also just recently we've had Count Arthur Strong. And it is, I think sometimes we like to return to these classic formats, but it does have a modern twist. It's not like, so it could appeal to anyone. It could appeal to grandparents, kids, university graduates, people who've just come in from the factory. It really does appeal to everyone, and I think that's the secret of these knockabout comedies.
Let's have a listen to Vic and Bob.
In heaven, do you get horns under the hammer?
Are you a carrot?
Do you get Dickinson's Rattle Day?
It's not 20 bloody questions, you pair of idiots.
Oh, an idiot, you say?
It sounds nonsensical.
Yeah, I think you've got a little hint of the flavour. It's this Vic and Bob, they've been going for 25 years, and some people are saying this is the best thing they've done since they first broke through on Channel 4. It's that good. So maybe I've only given you a flavour of it. Just it's on Monday nights at 10 p.m. In fact, I by coincidence, it's on exactly the same time as Catastrophe. So you'll have to watch one.
So your ability to operate a remote control will be tested that evening. Let us move on, if this is all right with you, to the idea of an all-star benefit gig. There has been, probably about 15, 20 years now, comedians gearing themselves up to be funny for charitable money. The Britain has an institution called Comic Relief, which is every couple of years, funny people stand up and try and raise money. But the live show is now the key way of raising money.
Yeah, and it's funny, you sort of you wait ages for a sort of good live show to come up. And this week, if you're in London, there are two fantastic comedy benefit gigs. I mean, they're both, again, by coincidence, they're for homeless charities. On the 23rd of February, there's a comedy gig for Centrepoint Charity. And on the 25th, there's one for for Shelter.
He doesn't strike me as a man who needs an awful lot of help, homeless, at least until the end of the week.
But that's probably my pick of the two. Eddie Izzard, who hasn't played in London for a while. I mean, he's well known for playing all around the world. He's done gigs in French. He's done gigs in German. I think he's planning on doing some gigs in the Middle East next, as well as having sort of political ambitions. He's headlining a gig. And I like these gigs because they're, if you're a comedy fan who doesn't go to a lot of live comedy, you get to see a whole selection of comedians. So, you know, on the Eddie Izzard bill, he's supported by Adam Hills and Josh Widdicombe, Sarah Pascoe. So you get to see a lot of comedians do 15, 20 minutes of their act. And then if you like them, you can buy a ticket. So they're not doing it completely for charity. I think partly they're doing it so you might buy tickets for them when they go on tour.
One does ask, you know, the likes of Eddie Izzard, they really don't need to do this kind of thing, do they?
He doesn't. I mean, I think he's obviously, he doesn't need the money either. He's happy to sort of, you know, if it's a cause like Shelter, the homelessness charity, I think Eddie Izzard really wants to support that cause. But it's also, you know, if, with your, with my sort of cynical journalist's hat on, you can also say that things like this, you know, it keeps their name in the public eye. And also, I think comedians like to do it because it's a chance to try out new material. It's not their official show where they're doing their official touring performance. So they can sometimes slip in new gags and try out new things and see if it works.
The opportunity to take a few more risks.
Mm, exactly. So it makes it exciting. It makes it a bit more unpredictable.
Let us talk finally about a return to satire.
Yeah, I think we've got an election coming up at some point in May, I think, is what we're talking about. And,
I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, there isn't. Well, I think we're going to start hearing more about it. And there's not a lot of satire in comedy, not in stand-up comedy at the moment. It is more of the kind of silly, surreal stand-up at the moment. But Matt Ford is probably, you know, the sort of top political comic at the moment of his generation. He used to actually work as an advisor to the Labour Party, and then he became a stand-up comedian. But he's a sort of cross-party critic. He's as critical of the Labour Party as he is of the Conservatives and Nick Clegg. He's also a very good impressionist. So not only does he sort of take apart the policies of the political parties, he also, you know, he's just opened at the Soho Theatre in London, and he's there for the next week and then on tour. You actually feel that Ed Miliband is in the room with you, and he does a brilliant Boris Johnson impression, which is very, very, you really do think Boris is in the room.
What a thought. I mean, just looking more broadly at the idea of satire, it is something that has fallen away, arguably, in the United Kingdom for a long time, yet it's very strong in other countries. I mean, France thrives on it. It still has Le Guignol. Italy lives and breathes satire, despite often being in the pocket of those who it mocks. But why? What is it about the British strain of satire that just left us for a while?
I don't know. I think comedy, it's a bit like, it feels like music, like pop music. It kind of goes in waves. So you'll get a wave where dance music is fashionable, and similarly in comedy, you'll get a wave where silly comedy is fashionable, and then dance music will fall out of fashion and guitars will come back into fashion. And I think the same thing happens with comedy. So you sort of get a backlash, you get sort of silliness. And then maybe people get a bit fed up with silliness and people start taking comedy a bit more seriously and want the serious stuff. And maybe this is what's happening. You know, we've had this wave of silly comedy with Miranda and Vic and Bob and Count Arthur Strong. Maybe with the election coming up and all sorts of things, you know, going on in the world, that, you know, we comedians are sort of grappling. There have been such serious issues happening in the world.
I also wonder whether it has something to do with the fact that satire went away when there were politicians that people initially took very seriously, the likes of Tony Blair promising a brand new, fresh new start. And yet we live in this world of almost universal dissatisfaction with those who lead us, and democracy itself is being examined. I mean, how much of an absolute gift is that to satirists?
Well, I think certainly the current government is, you know, and the opposition is, and again, Boris Johnson, obviously, in London, is great for satirists. I remember when David Cameron was first elected, I think there was a bit of panic amongst satirists saying things like, oh, it's too bland. How can we make jokes about the government? They're too bland. But government, you know, time after time, you soon realise they've got a personality. It just takes us a few years, you know, in power to sort of get a handle on the things about them that you can send up and find funny and critique. And I think, obviously, you know, I think this government, you know, and everyone, you know, and then obviously Nigel Farage at UKIP in the UK, there's so many different angles you can find in comedy now. I think that's why satire in the run-up to the election is going to be stronger than ever.
Bruce Tesser, thank you very much indeed. Bruce is, of course, arts critics for the London's Evening Standard newspaper. That is all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, the journalist and commentator Geoffrey Kaufman and Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London. My thanks also to our producer Thomas Lewis, our researchers David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant, and our studio manager Bill Lutie. Next up, after the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs. That is, of course, Monocle 24's Business Hour. Your host for that will be Daniel Giacopelli. Then at 2200 hours London time, tune in to the Monocle Daily. I'll be back behind the microphone, joined by Andrew Muller for tonight's programme. Hope you can join us for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.